We are going to do a NBA playoff preview here on the Podium Game Podcast. I'm Brian Gibberman, just setting it up real quick. The goal is to talk to someone from every team in the Eastern Conference and the Western Conference. Part one, we're going to do the Eastern Conference. The Cleveland Cavaliers and Boston Celtics are facing off in the 2-7 series. First, we are going to get a Celtics perspective from John Corrales. You can follow him on Twitter at RedsArmy_John. He writes for the website RedsArmy.com. John, how you doing this morning?
Doing very well, thanks. How you guys doing?
I'm doing great. Last time we talked, it was before the Knicks-Celtics playoff series 2 years ago. I enjoyed that more.
Yeah. Well, that was a different time. And this is going to be interesting this year, but it's been a while since we've had something to get excited for in the playoffs anyway.
Yeah, so you guys, in the regular season, you went 2-2 against the Cavs, but, I mean, there's really basically nothing to read into that based on who was really playing in those games, right?
No, I mean, basically I think the Celtics went 0-2 versus the Cavs, and the two wins came when they sat everybody for the second game of a home-and-home series. And then that first game, they didn't play. Well, Kyrie was out. LeBron and Kevin Love sat out the fourth quarter, and they basically kind of sat out, quote-unquote, the entire game by not playing very hard. So I'm not reading anything into the two wins against Cleveland at all.
You guys weren't really supposed to be in this situation where you were playing in a playoff series this year. At what point during the season were you kind of like, this is a thing that could actually happen?
Well, probably a few weeks ago, actually. There was a long stretch there where it seemed possible, and I just dismissed it. I thought, you know, look, this is all fun, this is all nice, but there's no way the Celtics are going to make the playoffs because they shouldn't make the playoffs. But I think what happened was a combination of a few things, and all of them worked out in the Celtics' favor. First of all, Isaiah Thomas went nuts as the sixth man, probably sixth man of the year at this point. I mean, this guy went completely crazy, scoring like a superstar, leading the league in fourth quarter scoring, 20-point games off the bench, which is insane. And so that really, Isaiah Thomas was better than the Celtics thought that he would be. Other pieces that they got in exchange for Rondo and for Jeff Green worked out. And even when they made the trade to Detroit and they got Jonas Jerebko, these guys all kind of filled specific roles that worked within the framework of the Celtics system. It's just kind of weird. It's like almost like trading this big, expensive dining room table for a bunch of pieces, and all of a sudden the room comes together. You know, it's just kind of weird how everything just worked out. And so, and beyond that, Indiana kind of self-destructed. The Brooklyn Nets are an abomination to basketball. With the talent level that they have, to not even be able to make the playoffs is ridiculous. They should be ashamed in Brooklyn. And the Miami Heat, with bad luck, with the Bosch blood clot, Whiteside kind of flipping out and getting hurt a little bit, and just things just not quite working out there. All of those things combined for the Celtics to propel them into the seventh seed.
In a way, you guys were kind of this year's Suns. Like, everyone thought the Suns were tanking when they traded away Gortat and some of their other veteran pieces, and they got a bunch of draft picks back in return, and everyone thought they were going to rebuild, but they ended up being halfway decent. The only problem was they were in a much harder conference. They were a higher-level team than the Celtics were this year, but you guys ended up being that, like, young, fun team that people kind of rooted for, and because of the crappiness of the East, were able to get into the playoffs versus the Suns when they weren't able to.
Yeah, it's a good comparison. There's some similarities there, but you're right. The West, a different story. But in the East, yeah, this is kind of how it went with the Celtics. Everybody, I don't think anybody really truly thought that they were going to make that playoff push. But they just kept on coming. They kept on winning. And, you know, amazingly, they were, I think, 10-1 in their last 11 second half of back-to-back games, which shows you, I mean, Brad Stevens had this team ready to go. It's mind-blowing some of the things they were able to do. And they were able to take advantage of a bad conference. That's a big part of it. They did take advantage of a bad conference. It seemed like no other team really wanted that last seed, the last two seeds, except for the Celtics.
Would have you preferred them to tank and ended up with the top five pick or make the playoffs? What was your preference?
Well, my preference would be, I mean, considering where this team is, would have been to miss the playoffs. I think that would have been more beneficial in the long run. But I've always been a big advocate of teams go out and they should play hard and they should coach the right way, and wherever the chips fall. So I was never going to get upset about them making the playoffs. I'm not really disappointed. I don't think it's necessarily the best course for the Celtics to take in their rebuild, but I can't complain because it shows you how good a coach the Celtics have and how good some of these players really are. So what am I going to be upset that these guys are better than we thought? I can't do that. But I mean, obviously, when you're a young team and you're rebuilding, if they could have gotten into the top five and gotten, you know, if not a franchise changing player, a guy who could make a significant contribution to the team, that would be better. But now they have to adjust. The playoff experience will be good for them. Even if they get smoked in four straight games, they'll at least have an idea of where they stand against the better teams in the conference. And then they can, you know, move forward accordingly. And I'll tell you this, it's a little easier to swallow when you look at the haul of draft picks Danny Ainge has, and you can go to a plan B and go through free agency or draft. I mean, not draft, or trade to rebuild your team that way. So plan A, the draft didn't quite work out, but Danny has a pretty solid plan B in place. So making the playoffs isn't, you know, one of those crushing, I can't believe this is going to set us back type of things.
What's the lineup you want to see get the majority of the minutes in this series?
I think, you know, status quo. Marcus Smart and Avery Bradley are your starting guards. I think they are going to be part of the future. I like Jay Crowder. I probably want to start Crowder, but because Evan Turner has been working out so well handling the ball, then you kind of just go with it. And what's the difference? Are you going to have Crowder guarding LeBron to be, what, a bigger speed bump than Evan Turner? I don't know. I don't think that's a big deal. So I don't care really who gets the time. Maybe I'd get a few more minutes for Jared Sullinger just to give him a little bit more experience. But all of those guys are going to get plenty of minutes anyway. They're all going to get their chance to run through the gauntlet and get smacked. So this isn't necessarily a thing where I think certain guys need to get 30 minutes because they're the future of the team. None of these guys are safe. Not a single guy on this team is really safe when it comes to this summer and trades. So just trot out the lineup that they've been trotting out and let them let it, whatever happens, happen.
All right, so the lead from your recap, it was Chuck's, I believe, actually, from after the Raptors game, was boom, where LeBron at? We coming for you, King James. In jest, or is there an aura of confidence coming from Boston fans right now that they actually think this can be a series?
I think that's kind of in jest. But look, hey, this is a playoff series. And no matter who the fight is against, I could be walking into the ring against a guy who's 8 feet tall, 300 pounds of solid muscle, and, you know, a black belt in 10 different styles of martial arts. It doesn't matter. I can't sit there and be afraid. I got to say, all right, well, let me see if I can take it down. And you just, this is it, you know, bring it on. But I don't think anybody here truly expects the Celtics to put up much of a fight. Maybe when they come home, they can get some of that energy, and they can get kind of a relaxed Cavs team and sneak out a win and make it a five-game series. I really don't think anybody's harboring any sort of misconceptions that the Celtics are going to do anything constructive against the Cavs unless something catastrophic happens to the Cavs and, you know, Irving and LeBron go down with injury in game one. Like, it's going to take something just ridiculously out of control catastrophic for the Celtics to have a chance in this.
Is there still a level of distaste towards LeBron in Boston?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a general opposing team kind of attitude towards LeBron. He's kind of been the villain, especially in Boston, because they've had so many battles with him here. You know, the classic when, in 08 when the Celtics made their run, and a bunch of battles since then. I mean, that the Pierce-LeBron rivalry. And then when Ray Allen went to Miami, it really just amped up the hatred. So a lot of people in Boston hate LeBron. They would love nothing more than to make this difficult for him. If the Celtics won this series, it might be like winning the championship. So, but, yeah, I think there's plenty of hate for LeBron. You'll hear in game one it's game three, but the first game at the Garden, he'll be booed plenty when he gets the ball.
Anything you would like to plug?
Well, hey, I mean, plug the website, redsarmy.com. Come on by, check it out. Lots of fun stuff. We like to have some fun with it. Nothing specific. We'll come up with some sort of, like, holy crap, we made the playoffs type preview. But I think what we're going to do is we're just going to have fun with it on the site because, like I said, we know what's coming. This isn't like we're not going crazy thinking like, hey, we got a chance. I don't. And some fans obviously might, but I think we know what's coming. We're just going to have some fun with it. And anytime, anywhere we can tweak LeBron and tweak the Cavs and tweak some Cavs fans, we'll do it.
As John just said, go check out RedsArmy.com. You can follow him on Twitter, RedsArmy_John, John Corrales. Thanks for helping us out with the Celtics portion of the Cavs Celtics preview.
You're welcome.
We go from the underdog in the series to the favorite. We're going to talk some Cleveland Cavaliers now with Jacob Rosen. You can follow him on Twitter at WFNY. Jacob, he writes for the sports analytics blog, Waiting for Next Year, and Nylon Calculus. Make sure you go check all those out. Jacob, how you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. Always love having you jump on for a couple minutes. So when they made those trades, they got Mozgov, JR, Shumpert. Did you think it would come together this well?
I didn't think it would come together this well, per se. I remember it was mid to late January. They were starting to hum a little bit. But they were still hovering mostly around 500, and I kept like adjusting, like, where are we going to end up at? 50 wins, maybe? 51? And there were a few people that were the crazy optimists that were saying 53, and here we are on the last day of the season with them with a chance to win 53 games. And that just means they've been playing at that crazy 60-win pace, and they've rested mostly the last week. So I did not expect them to go on the 30-7 run that they had. I don't think anybody expected them to play as dominantly as they have, very Warriors-like, for the last 2.5 months. It's been what people expected in October, but finally here after a half a season of 500 ball. It's been a weird kind of confluence of events, and those trades turned out much better than most people could have ever expected.
I was at the game in Phoenix when LeBron came back from his sabbatical or whatever, and I was sitting in the crowd, and I was just like, oh, okay, that guy is going to be around here. So.
He had some moments in that. I remember listening to that game, driving back from Seattle. I had gone to the national championship game between Ohio State and Oregon. I was driving back from Seattle. It was a crazy travel day. And I was listening to that game on the radio. Like, I had it on, like, on my phone, whatever, League Pass thing. And I was like, okay, this LeBron guy, he's good again. But they ended up losing that game, of course. And then that game, that close loss, seemed to be like a kick in the butt. And they went on the streak where they beat the Clippers badly and beat up on the Bulls and on and on and on, beat just about everyone, besides, it seems like, the Pacers. And that was 2.5 months, and ever since that Phoenix game.
Do you think Mozgov needs to play for them to go as far as they can in the playoffs? Do you think he needs to play more?
It just depends. Like, I don't expect him to be necessarily that big of a factor in Boston, of course. But when you talk about the matchups, it just depends. Like, against the Chicago Bulls, to match up against that front court of Noah and Gasol when they're humming, yeah, you need a big body like Mozgov down low. But when you're matching up against the Hawks, and this was the case in a couple of regular season games when Mozgov was part of the Cavs, and they played the Hawks, I guess it was just one, Mozgov didn't play that much, just because it wasn't a good fit, and they need to be flexible and mobile enough to guard the guys like Perantich and Al Horford, and that's not necessarily Mozgov's role for 30 minutes in a game like that. So I would expect to see more Tristan Thompson at the five kind of lineups, a lot of Kevin Love and small ball LeBron at the four kind of things, to match up against a team like Atlanta. So we'll see. Just with Mozgov, you know, he's a guy that's perennially in foul trouble, and I don't think him resting in fourth quarters, like Kevin Love resting in fourth quarters, has been a terrible thing by any means. It just depends on how the game is going.
And does anything about the Celtics worry you?
No. I'd be shocked if they win two games. I'll say that. Like, you know, the Celtics have been an impressive team. Isaiah Thomas has been crazy good. But nothing really worries me when the Cavs are at full strength with the big three healthy. The one game that was during this run since that Suns game, where the Cavs are at full strength, they beat it by 30. Obviously, the Celtics returned the favor last week when all the guys were out, but nothing really worries me that much in the series. It would be fun.
So if the series over-under is set at 4.5, it sounds like you're taking the under.
I wouldn't take the under. I think I would take probably the over just because I'm terribly conservative on just about every projection, anything. I would probably take the over and say just 5. But that's because, you know, I'm really bad at guessing things usually.
How do you think the three are Love, Irving, and LeBron? Is it coming together more? I used coming together already in an earlier question, so I don't want to do that again. Have they become more cohesive, or is it just flat out more talent?
I think they've become more cohesive. I think they've learned how to play a little bit together. Earlier in the season, you could see the frustrations just on the court when the guys didn't have the ball in their hands, especially when you look at the Love and LeBron kind of combination. Everyone expected that to be seamless, and it wasn't. Whether that was LeBron actually going full effort, or I know Zach Lowe inferred that he might not have been in great shape at the beginning of the season, I'm not sure. But when you've seen them play and seen their interactions on the ball and had the floor spacing of a guy like J.R. Smith, who's a professional shooter, and had the big man presence of Mozgov, yeah, they've had more talent on there. But I think that has allowed them to relax a little bit on the court and feel comfortable with where they are in the systems. Like, it felt a lot of forced action at the beginning of the year. And still, the Cavs oftentimes look to just overpower teams where they're running fast breaks or LeBron's just running into the basket and just hammering into them. And that's enough, and there should be enough against Boston. But I think there have been so many different times where the offense is just flowing and they go on these 15-2 backbreaking runs and the game's pretty much over from there. And so it's just going a lot better. It's going as we thought it should be when you talk about those three offensive talents together on the court. Early in the year, whenever one of those guys sat, it would just fall apart. And I think now Blatt has figured out how to coach a little bit better with those three. The talent around them has made them feel better, and it's hard to get much more optimistic about the way that they're playing offense and the way that Mozgov's been helping them play defense.
Does all of that talent take a little bit of a load off J.R. Smith and maybe allow him to have more success in the playoffs than he's had recently when he's been higher up on the totem pole on teams, or is that something that we should be keeping an eye on if J.R. kind of falls back into old struggles that he's had in the playoffs recently?
I don't foresee J.R. Smith having the kind of issues he might have had with the Knicks. Like, I remember sharing a shot chart of J.R. Smith with the Knicks and J.R. Smith with the Cavs, and you know, his best season 2 years ago when he's sixth man of the year. And it's kind of similar. Like, there's a lot of threes. He's taken about 2/3 of his shots from threes, but I remember getting called out on Twitter for it because it's an entirely different role. He's an entirely different part of a system here in Cleveland than he was in New York. There in New York, it was him and Melo. And when Melo wasn't on the court, when Melo wasn't leading the entire set, it was J.R. Smith. That was his role. Here in Cleveland, they have LeBron as the number one point guard in Kyrie, and J.R. Smith's almost primary role ever is just to take threes. He'll do that in rhythm. He'll do that, you know, kind of leading the ball just a little bit. But the pressure is off of him to ever really create in pressure situations or probe the defenses. His job's to space the floor and to shoot threes and to shoot them a lot and to shoot them well. And he's done that with flying colors in Cleveland. So I would expect that to be more of the case in terms of any postseason jitters or the postseason pressures of defenses. Like when you look into a series with the Bulls and Thibodeau, you won't see what J.R. Smith might have done in the past because the pressure will be on guys like LeBron and Kyrie to really read those defenses and get J.R. the ball away from him.
Now, I'd say about a month ago, I kind of thought that the Cleveland team was kind of like the Miami team in LeBron year one, where they're the most talented team, but just not everything has exactly came together yet. And I could have seen the Hawks playing that role of the Mavs as the more cohesive unit who was able to beat them, just ball movement, playing good team defense. I don't know if I really think that anymore as we look forward and what seems like an inevitable Hawks Cavs conference finals. Do you like that matchup for Cleveland?
As much as you can. I think a lot of people do underappreciate what the Hawks have done this season, what they did to the Cavs in a couple different matchups. This is a 60-win team that a lot of times, you know, they got blown out a few times. This is weird, but we underappreciate how amazing these Hawks are and how well they played against Cleveland in some of the games. So as much as I like any matchup against an incredible team like that, yeah, I think the Cavs can do well if they've played like they've played the last 3 months and don't fall into some of the bad habits from earlier in the season. The Thabo Sefolosha thing harms them against these new Cavs because you're going to be running around chasing JR. You're going to be making sure that you can stay in front of LeBron when he has a lot more weapons around him, when there's the threat of lobbing it up to Mozgov or dishing it back out to Kyrie to try and do something similar as well. So that's just what the Cavs are now, is they're a more dynamic threat. And that one game against the Hawks when they had full strength back in early March, the Cavs didn't play well at all. Like, they looked out of sync. And then, you know, it was like a 10-point game in the end that was closer than it felt. But I think the Cavs have even improved since then in terms of getting people on the same page. So, well, I would not be surprised by the Cavs. Like, I would expect as of now the Cavs to fall to somebody, be it the Hawks or in the finals. I don't expect the Cavs to win at all per se, but I think this is a team good enough where if you get good LeBron, like we've seen the last couple months, anything really could happen just because of how dominant that force is and how dominant he makes all the people around him. And I think to a certain extent, like, the Miami, we underappreciate them too in terms of how amazing they were. And so there's a lot of things that need to happen for any one team to just sweep through the playoffs like that. And the Cavs will have issues with those Hawks.
So after the Hawks, what team do you think could give the Cavs trouble?
In the East?
Yeah, in the East, not the West.
I would have rather played the Raptors, and I think most Cavs fans would agree with that. We've beat up on the Raptors pretty good this season, and with regards to the Bulls, their height, their kind of star power worries you anytime. You know, we haven't done well against the Thibodeau teams really ever, you worry if D. Rose can contribute like he has just a little bit, just a little bit in some of the games recently, that team is still very, very good. And the Raptors, I think we know what they are to a certain extent, and the Cavs have matched up well. So that Bulls series would certainly be fun. I don't expect it to be a severe series because I think the Bulls are still in a little bit of disarray. But yeah, that's the only team like that worries me. And I think the Bulls will be pushed to the limit pretty well by Jason Kidd and his staff with the Bucks. You know, that's just at least what it looks like now. So if it's the Raptors that the Cavs match up with in the semifinals in the East, I wouldn't be too concerned, or the Wizards as well.
Anything,
wherever that happens.
Anything you would like to plug?
Sharing the plug for some of the websites I write for, I suppose, a sports analytics blog and Nylon Calculus. There should be lots of good playoff stuff from the Nylon Calculus site in the coming weeks. And it should be fun to see how dominant this Cavs team might be. Back in the mid to late 2000s, when those Cavs teams had those first round matchups, it was just like a walk in the park. I would expect Boston to impress some people just in terms of the season that they've had and maybe steal a game, so we'll see what happens.
Jacob, thank you very much for helping out with the Cavs-Celtics preview.
Absolutely, man. Look forward to chatting next round.
All right. Talk to you later. We go from Cavaliers-Nets to who the Cavs could potentially face in the second round. The Bulls and Bucks are squaring off in the 3-6 series of the Eastern Conference playoffs. That series will start Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. The Bulls took 3-4 during the regular season, but 1-1 since the trade deadline and the changes with the Bucks. For the Chicago perspective, we start with Kevin Ferragan. He's from Vlogable.com, Nylon Calculus, among some other places. Kevin, how you doing today?
Doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. All right, so is this a series you think Thibodeau can get away with screwing around with his big man combinations and playing Mirotić at the three a little bit, or do you think he has to be really on point with his rotations from that position in this series?
Well, so I'm a little bit of two minds about this. The good thing about this series is, from a Bulls fan's perspective, is that it's probably the only matchup available where Pau Gasol could really be useful in the first round in the East for the Bulls. He has done pretty well against the Bucks this year, and especially earlier in the year. He had a 46-point game, I think it was, where he just abused them basically down low. In the later meetings in the year, he didn't quite have the same success. But I think that if there's a team that Thibodeau overplaying Pau, that they'll be able to get away with that, it's probably the Bucks. I'm a little bit worried about the jumbo lineup, as Bulls fans have taken to calling it, just because it really limits what the Bulls when the Bulls are at their best, which is when Nikola Mirotić is at the power forward spot, and you have a traditional center, whether that's Pau or Joakim Noah. You know, either one of them with Mirotić just works a lot better than the other way, having the two of them together, because they just get in each other's way, and it forces Noah typically to run around on the perimeter a lot more than he is really able to with his knee being bad. But on the flip side, I think that Jason Kidd is a little bit better tactically as a coach than Thibodeau. Thibodeau is a little bit stubborn and slow to adjust, whereas I think that Kidd has shown himself to be pretty innovative. And so I think that that Kidd might have an answer for Gasol. And if Thibodeau stays stubborn and keeps with Gasol for too long, I think that could be a problem for the Bulls.
Yeah, what last year in that first round series against the Raptors, he went to like Allen Anderson in the starting lineup, I believe, after a couple games when he saw what he had been doing. He took out Sean Livingston and went with Allen Anderson for more shooting after the Nets had all that success in the regular season. That's a good point on Kidd being willing to adjust quickly. What injury updates? What's the late? I know there's. I thought Gibson got hurt on Wednesday. I know Rose didn't finish. You mentioned Noah. Well, what's the latest on all that stuff?
So far as I know, Noah has said that he's going to play on Saturday. He's been kind of hobbled all year, down the stretch with Noah out, it actually worked out okay for a little bit, because you had Pau playing center, and then you had Mirotić, as I mentioned, playing his traditional four spot a lot more frequently. And there's just a lot more space on the floor offensively. And Mirotić coming in had a reputation for not really being a good defensive player, but I actually think that that's not the case. He's got very active hands for a big man. He racks up steals at a pretty good clip, and he even blocks shots to some degree. I mean, he's not, you know, Taj Gibson on in terms of rim protection or anything remotely like that, but he blocks shots. He's very active. He does a good job of fronting the post and making guys work for post position. And you know, he has quick enough feet that nobody's gonna blow by him in like the face up game or anything like that. The help defense is hit or miss sometimes, but he's gotten a lot better at that too over the course of the year. So I think he's, you know, firmly a plus defender. So you add that with the fact that he spaces the floor, and it's been pretty good. Yeah, and so that has, Noah being out is actually, you know, they've actually looked a little bit better, which is kind of counterintuitive, but I think they're going to need Noah, obviously, to, you know, to make any kind of run in the playoffs. And I just don't know if he's going to be 100%. He hasn't really been all year. And I guess, but the upside is that they were able to get the wins they needed to get the 3 seed and still get him rest at the end of the year. Gibson has a shoulder strain. He left the game and I guess got a cortisone shot, which doesn't sound great, but Taj is going to play because that's pretty much what he does. Taj playing when he's injured is just not the same guy. He's had some ankle injuries and issues like that. And, before he left the game last night, he was playing pretty terribly. And he relies a lot on, you know, being able to extend his arms, because he has, you know, kind of, go-go gadget arms a little bit, and he also relies on his athleticism, and so having a shoulder injury and, you know, having the lower body injuries, the ankle injuries that he's had all year, it's really sapped a lot of his effectiveness, and so that's a problem. And the Bulls, I mean, he's one of the Bulls' more athletic players, and the Bulls just don't have a lot of athleticism anymore. Rose is still really fast, but doesn't have the vertical explosion that he used to. Taj is not the athlete that he was because he's been so injured. Same goes for Noah. And then, you know, Mike Dunleavy is a very good player. I like him a lot, but he's not, you know, much of an athlete at the NBA level. He's got length and all of that, but he's not an explosive guy by any means. And then, so basically you're left with Jimmy Butler is like the only real athlete that the Bulls have anymore. So that's a concern, especially facing a Bucks team that is pretty athletic. As far as Rose goes, apparently he just had some soreness, not in the knee that he had the most recent surgery in, the meniscus, but his other knee. And so it seems like he's just bouncing back and forth between having knee issues. He said that he's felt that kind of soreness before, and it wasn't a big deal. But I don't know. Anytime Derrick Rose says there's something wrong with his knee, alarm bells go ringing in my head. So, you know, to quote Rose, I would just say, who knows what's going to be the case with him. And, you know, obviously if they don't have Rose, I think that pretty much destroys any chance they have of playing spoiler to Atlanta or the Cavs.
So how would you deal with Rose in the – this is two parts. How would you deal with Rose during the postseason? How do you think Thibodeau deals with Rose during the postseason? Or maybe that's the same.
Well, it's – I think it's – well, because it's the playoffs, I think that – I'm a little bit more fine with Thibodeau kind of playing Rose under the assumption that he can play. I guess this is maybe just a selfish fan in me, but I don't know how many more Derrick Rose games we really have, just because he just keeps getting hurt. And so, you know, from that perspective, they have a team that if Rose is going really well, they have a team that has a very small puncher's chance of making a run for a title. And I don't think that that's going to be the case for much longer because their front court is aging and because Rose looks like he could be Rose has the potential to be, you know, not much of anything beyond the end of this contract, because if his injuries keep piling up. So I think you kind of just have to take the chance this time through and, you know, try to make a run. So I think that they'll probably play him, you know, as much as he's physically able to, which is a little bit scary for him, I guess. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see because he didn't play that second half. So and he was the one that requested to sit out. It'll be interesting to see whether there's any sort of drama surrounding that or not. But I'm hoping not. I'm trying to not get too down about it. But my tendency is to fear the worst. And, you know, with that, with Rose, the worst would be that he ends up not being able to really play very much these playoffs again. And, you know, that would be pretty awful.
The Bucks are a +550 to win this series. A lot of people seem to like that. Do you agree with them, or are you more confident in the Bulls than others?
I think that I was more confident earlier on when the Bulls looked like they were going to be rolling in pretty healthy. And of course, then, you know, Noah sat out the last couple of games. You know, Rose looked really good in the game they played against the Sixers, and granted, that was the Sixers, and the Sixers were also without Nerlens Noel or any of their point guards. So, you know, giant, like, huge mound of salt with that. But he looked really good, and then he played very well against the Nets, you know, pretty soon thereafter. So I was feeling very confident. I didn't really think that the Bucks did a chance. I was definitely more confident with them versus against the Wizards, just given what happened last year with the Wizards' front court beating up on the Bulls' front court, and Noah not being 100% and Taj not being 100%. I was just like, that front court kind of scared me a little bit. So I was happy to not have to play them. But, you know, like I mentioned earlier, I do think the kid is a little bit kid probably provides them a little bit of an edge in terms of tactics and you know, ability to make adjustments. I'm kind of down on Thibodeau. A lot of people think he's a top five coach in the league. I don't think he's that. I think he's fine. Like, I think he's got some things that he does well, and I think he has a fair number of things that he is pretty not great at. Lineups is one of them. Installing an offensive system that has any sort of continuity and motion to it. I don't think he's done a very good job of that. The Bulls often bog down in post up isolations, which I complain about frequently. And he also runs guys into the ground, which is like the biggest criticism of him. But I think the other two are actually maybe more important, is that he doesn't necessarily play lineups that make sense together. The jumbo lineup being sort of the one that gets the most flack for that, because it really neutralizes all of the best qualities of the players in it. So Jimmy Butler and Derrick Rose, you know, for all of Derrick Rose's faults, one of the things that he still does really well is drive to the basket, and Jimmy Butler is the same way. He's a very good driver when he takes the opportunity to drive. And so having those two guys who are not really good shooters, Butler's been better this year, but he's still not like, you know, Kyle Korver or Stephen Curry or any kind of elite shooter. So you need those driving lanes for those guys for them to be at their most effective. But he plays them with Nikola Mirotic at the three, and the two big guys in the front court, who are both, you know, the Bulls don't, aside from Mirotic, all of the Bulls' front court players are not floor spacers. And so that bogs up the paint so that Rose and Butler can't drive as easily. And it also just makes it easier for the guys that are inside to be covered, because there's just a mess of people in the paint pretty much at all times when they play that lineup. And he continues to go to it, and I don't really know why that is. I don't know if he just feels like he has to play Pau Gasol all these minutes, and if he plays Mirotić at the power forward, somehow he's not going to be able to do that. But whatever the reason, it's just really bad. And he also, you know, Heinrich is out injured right now, and I don't know when he's going to be back or if he's going to be back. But he also, you know, relied way too much on him this year at the expense of Tony Snell, who definitely had games where he was, like, you know, a ghost on offense. But, like, that's Heinrich pretty much every time. He is such a non-threat on the floor that teams just don't guard him. Like, there's, like, a ton of screenshots out there that Bulls fans and Bulls writers have posted, Bulls bloggers mostly, not Bulls writers. The Bulls beat writers treat Kirk with kid gloves, just like the organization does. But he is just not guarded. And the reason, I guess, for playing him over Snell is that he's a better team defender than Snell, which is definitely true. Like, Snell is really bad at navigating screening actions, and he's really bad at help defense, like his responsibilities on that. But in one-on-one defense, he's very good because he has those physical tools, the length and all of that. He plays passing lanes decently well. But he's just, teams respect him as a shooter, and he also can put the ball on the deck and get into the paint and dunk, and, you know, he can do stuff. And Heinrich can't do any stuff anymore. But Thibodeau, you know, is just, he's stubborn. And so anyways, that's a sort of long-winded way of saying that I worry about Thibodeau versus Kidd, because I just think the Kidd is better at making those sorts of adjustments and having a sense of what lineups are going to work based on how his team is being played. Like, the fact that Thibodeau has run the jumbo lineup as much as he has, seeing that it's not working and then continues to go to it, just doesn't do a lot for my confidence in his, you know, I don't know, in what he's seeing out there, because it just seems like he's so focused on defense that he ignores the other side of the ball, and it really makes for a frustrating team to watch. So that's why I complain a lot about Thibodeau.
Do you have you got anything you would like to plug and get out there?
I've been writing posts every Monday, starting over the last 2 weeks, at Today's Fast Break, which is a new website that's out there. I've been just doing these little quick hits they call them Fast Break Factoids. I wrote about 2 weeks ago, I wrote about Stephen Curry being incredible off the dribble, and then he, you know, promptly went out and went Nova in a big game, which was nice because it was like, oh, that was the game where everybody was like, oh yeah, Steph is the MVP because he did it on national TV, even though he's been doing it all year. And then the next week I wrote about the Thunder's defense being their real problem, not Russell Westbrook, because they don't have any interior defense. And that's kind of irrelevant now because they're out of playoffs, but I saw a lot of people talking about, or a lot of talk about, you know, Russell Westbrook shoots too much, and or Russell Westbrook just dominates the ball too much. And, you know, if you look at their roster, they just don't have a lot of talent outside of him, with Ibaka and Durant especially missing in action. So, yeah, he had to dominate the ball, but their defense was really the thing that killed them down the stretch. They couldn't stop anybody, which is kind of what happens when, you know, Enes Kanter is your center, and you have Dion Waiters playing rotation-level minutes. those two guys are pretty bad.
All right, so go check that out. Today'sFastBreak.com?
Yep.
All right, so go check that out. Kevin, thank you very much, and hopefully we'll catch up with you later on in the playoffs.
Sounds great.
As we transition from the Bulls to the Bucks, our previous guest, Kevin Ferragan, gave us something interesting to talk about with the new guest, Eric Benning from SBNationsBrewHoop.com. Eric, how you doing today?
Doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. So Kevin is pretty adamant that Jason Kidd is an advantage over Tom Thibodeau. Do you agree or disagree with that stance?
I think for now, I'm going to disagree just based on the fact that in Kidd's 2 years as a coach, he's only had 1 year in Brooklyn, 1 year in Milwaukee. So I don't want to say he won't have consistency as a head coach, but he hasn't had it displayed yet. So for right now, I don't want to give Kidd the advantage over Tibbs because Tibbs has proven it in the regular season and the playoffs. But what I will say is Kidd does seem a little more willing to adapt, like off of his game plans. So maybe that's kind of where Kevin was going to. I know Tibbs is more of a traditional guy and a conservative guy on the offense and defense. But, yeah, he doesn't really like to switch it up too much. So maybe that's where Kidd might have an advantage. But for now, I'm going to stick with the more experienced guy and chip it up.
You nailed it. That was the exact point that Kevin made regarding why, or at least part of the reason why he liked Kidd over Thibodeau was he used examples of the Nets-Raptors series last year, how Kidd made adjustments as that series went on, and he doesn't think Thibodeau would be willing to do something like that. And with the Bucks, I mean, there's a lot of lineup versatility there. How do you think they go about trying to match up with Chicago in this series?
Well, it's a little interesting. I know the whole point of Milwaukee's defense is kind of in the shadows of what Golden State's doing as well, where they have all these versatile players that can guard multiple positions so that if they do get switched off or something like that, they can easily do that and not be in too much of a disadvantage. As far as how they match up, Chicago's kind of tricky. I know a lot of people in Milwaukee weren't looking forward to matching up with Chicago. Their combination inside with Powell and Taj Gibson and Noah is a little tough for people like Zaza Pachulia and Ersan Ilyasova, more slower, or I guess that's a good way to describe them. What was I saying? Yeah, so the Bulls just kind of have an advantage in terms of experience and, I guess, just a more wide skill set, so to speak. So I think Chicago has the advantage there. Also, just in terms of how the Bucks would match up on the perimeter, it's an interesting matchup with guys like Jimmy Butler and Giannis Antetokounmpo, which is pretty easy to say.
You got that down pretty good. I have a question for him. I wrote Greek Freak down. I cheat.
Yeah, with time, it takes about 10 minutes. Just sit in front of the mirror and say it to yourself. You get used to it.
I can say I'm a Knicks fan, so I could say Giannis. I don't even know if that's right, but I just call him by his first name, and I just pretend the last name doesn't exist.
Well, for the record, it's Thanasis.
Thanasis. See, you're better than me, and you don't even root for him. God damn it.
You're like 60% of it, right? It's better than most people. So, but yeah, going back to that, on the wings and in the backcourt, I don't want to say Giannis and Jimmy Butler are a push because Jimmy Butler is probably going to be the most improved player. But it's kind of an interesting, like, Jimmy Butler will have an advantage of whoever guards him. But on the same end, I think Giannis, being as ridiculous as he is, will have an advantage on whoever guards him. And then just looking at point guards, I'm not sure what Derrick Rose's status is at this point. But the last time these two teams played, Jason Kidd just had Michael Carter-Williams take Aaron Brooks in the post on almost every single possession, and it worked out in MCW's favor. I think he had like 15 points in a quarter on Aaron Brooks, so it'll be interesting to see how Kidd uses his length and versatility to sort of combat the Bulls and their more traditional and like paint-based offense, I guess.
As Michael Carter-Williams has had more time to adjust and get comfortable with the Bucks, how has he started to fit in, and how have they looked with him in the lineup?
Well, I think the thing most people would point to right away is his inability to really shoot from anywhere outside of the paint. For now, I'm just looking at the stats right now. since they dealt for him, their offensive rating went from 102.1 to 97.5. And I think a lot of that, even though like the starting lineup stats for the Bucks haven't been too different since May left, I just think MCW's inability to shoot and kind of be a threat from the perimeter has kind of condensed the Bucks offense, so to speak. So I think he's starting to learn under Kidd like where his spots are and how he can be effective. But there's still, the Bucks still need some sort of replacement for Knight's ability to stretch the floor and give more open driving lanes to guys like Giannis or Chris Middleton, or hopefully in the future Jabari Parker. So they've looked okay, but there's still obviously a lot of room for them to grow on offense.
So I'm based out of Phoenix. Knight takes some horrid shots.
Yeah, he definitely does. Oh, I'm sorry, just go ahead.
No, that you can respond to that. I was just going to expand on that, but that covered it. He takes some horrid shots.
Yeah, he does. It's interesting because he made some really clutch shots for Milwaukee when they needed it, and right now they don't really have that guy who can step up at late in games and be willing to take and make that shot. But at the same time, I remember being really frustrated when he would come down on like three or four straight possessions and come off a pick and roll and pull up from like 20 feet and take a pretty difficult jumper. So it's interesting. I wonder what Phoenix, what they're going to do with him. Obviously this summer they need to make a decision on whether to pay him. So it'll be interesting.
And with like those shots, like if there was like 4 or 5 seconds left on the shot clock, you can live with it a little more. He's doing it with like 19 and 20 seconds left. You sit there and you're just like amazed. You're like, what in the world is going on here? All right, what's your excitement level for playoff Greek Freak?
It's really interesting because, I mean, in Giannis's rookie year, we were expecting nothing, or essentially nothing, and he came out and had these flashes of brilliance and all that. And this year, we were expecting slow improvement, and I forgot what his totals are right now, but he's even surpassed what he expected for this year. So it's hard for me, I'm just trying to think of a reasonable expectation for playoff Giannis. And I have, my projection is kind of what he's doing now, maybe more consistently, 15 points, 5 rebounds, 3 assists or whatever. But he's shown a penchant recently to play a little bit angry and play inspired, so I'm trying to remain optimistic, or not optimistic, realistic about Giannis in the playoffs. But he could surprise us once again and just take over a series. I have no idea. I'm very, very excited because his whole career, it's been a surprising and kind of exciting unknown.
Did it ever come out why he got benched for that game against the Knicks, or has that been kept completely silent?
Well, you know, Kidd said coach's decision in the press conference a bunch, and it was kind of explained the next day. There were a few rumors or reports or whatever that he did it to show his the other players that sometime they may have an important game and they might not have Giannis available. So I guess he did that in an effort to bond the other players, and maybe obviously there's the whole maybe he just lit a fire under Giannis, because he was kind of struggling in the game or two before that. But there hasn't really been anything definite as to why Kidd did it. It was just, like you said, it was a coach's decision, and obviously it worked out, as you saw in the Knicks game.
Well, right, anything you try works out in the Knicks game. That doesn't count.
That's true. That is true.
Yeah, okay, so it sounds like some sort of motivational ploy more, not that something bad happened or anything like that, or he screwed up or something like that. It seems some aspect motivationally, whether it was for Giannis or whether it was for his teammates, there was some sort of mind game being played there.
Yeah, I don't know for sure if there wasn't any minor disciplinary thing or not, but I think it was mostly just to kind of refocus Giannis and light a bit of a fire under him.
Cool. All right. That's good to know. Anything you would like to plug and get out there?
I guess if you're looking for some pretty high-quality Bucks coverage, obviously visit RootHoop.com. We have a lot of fun covering the Bucks, and we don't get to do playoff coverage too much, so thank you for the opportunity, and check us out.
All right, so go over to brewhoop.com. You can see what Eric Benning, Frank Madden, and all the other people over there do. It's good stuff. And thank you very much, Eric, for stopping by for the podcast. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good one.
We've already hit on Cavs Celtics. We've also touched on Bulls Bucks. Now we're going to head to the 1-8 seed in the Hawks versus the Nets. The Hawks swept the Nets in the regular season and won 3 of the games by a healthy margin. Game 1, 5:30 p.m. Sunday night. On TNT, Robbie Callen from HP and also does some college football stuff for fanbuzz.com. Robbie, how you doing today?
Doing well, Brian.
I've only seen like 2 of the Fast and Furious movies. Will you continue to do this podcast?
Begrudgingly.
Okay, thank you. Much appreciated. How big from a basketball context is the Thabo Sefolosha injury to what the Hawks are trying to accomplish in the postseason?
It's pretty big. Their defensive rating with him on the floor is vastly better than when he's off of it. I don't think the Nets particularly are the team that's going to be a problem, and I don't think any of the teams they really face in the second round would be the problem. The concern would be you really need 2 wing defenders that can rotate out when you face LeBron James. And Damari Carroll is good. Thabo is a little better defensively than Damari, I think. And not having Thabo to really be able to help on LeBron, I think that's the series that really catches up to them, especially because Damari is going to log heavy minutes all series because Bayes, as good as Bazemore's been, he really can't take the physical forwards the same way. Thab was a big guy. Bayes is super long and can contain guards, but he can get beat up in the post. Thabo is really good at that, and I think that's the series where it really catches up to him. And then Toronto, honestly, it could be a little tricky with DeMar as well, but I think they could get past that. But really, I think once you get to the Eastern Conference Finals, there's really going if they get there and they face the Cavs, I think that's where you'd really see them miss Thabo the most.
The other injury issue going on with Atlanta right now, Paul Millsap, he played in the last regular season game. How did he look, and was it good enough for you to have confidence in him going into the playoffs?
I think it's going to take a couple games for him to really get comfortable. He's wearing that one of those compression sleeve shirts to kind of cover up that right shoulder, and he didn't look super comfortable shooting with it. But I think that's something that'll come with a little game experience. I know at one point he's like 1-7 from the field, but he's knocking the rust off. I think he'll get used to that shirt over the next few days. And from a general health standpoint, from what I understand, is it's just more dealing with soreness than it is an actual structural injury. It's more of a soreness and whether he can deal with that, which Paul's one of the toughest guys on the team. And so I don't see him being limited too much by that. And so I think he'll be fine, but those first couple games, he might not be as efficient shooting the ball. You might not see him take as many threes early in this Nets series. You might see him look to pump and drive a little more because he's not quite as comfortable shooting with that compression shirt.
I asked this in the Western Conference about the Grizzlies. I feel like it's appropriate here too, though. Was the drop-off in the Hawks' play from where they were scorching hot, clearly one of the best teams in the league to start the year and for a good chunk of the season, more based around the injuries they've had? Or was it just maybe a little bit of complacency and you expect that to round into form now?
Yeah, I think it's a little mixture of both. I mean, they got banged up. Teague missed a few games. Millsaps missed a few games. Obviously, Thabo. There's been a lot of guys that have missed time. Mike Scott, honestly, I think people forget how important Mike Scott is to this team. From just bringing offense off the bench, he's one of the few guys on the team that's really a scorer from that bench unit. You know, you have Dennis and you have Mike, and then you have some other guys who are not going to be able to take any kind of load as a primary scorer, but Mike Scott can do that. And so missing him for extended time, I think that really hurt, and he's back and he looks good. So, I think that's a little combination of both, but at the same time, I think there is a little concern about how they were playing, a little concern about maybe just general fatigue from the season setting in. And you can rest guys all you want, but there's always going to be a little tired legs in the playoffs. And for a team that's so, especially defensively, is where you saw the slippage. And part of that's Thabo being out. But you saw some slippage because I think they got a little tired. And this is a team that hedges hard on pick and rolls and does a lot of chasing back and hard rotations around the court. And I think that it takes a little bit of a toll. We'll see if they can pick it back up in the playoffs.
You guys going to be nice to Joe Johnson or mean?
The team or the fans?
The fans.
Oh, they're going to boo the hell out of him, which I hate.
They really don't. Why do they hold it against him?
They shouldn't. As I've said, just generally, fans are dumb. this isn't a shot at Atlanta fans. This is just generally fans just aren't really good at looking any deeper than the surface level. And so they see a guy who got hella paid and think he wasn't worth it. And are going to lash out at him. Now, is it his fault? No. Talk to Billy. Talk to Billy Knight about that. Okay? That's who you need to be mad at. Talk to Billy Knight about some of those contracts. Here's the thing. If someone signs a contract in front of you and it's going to overpay you, you don't say no. You know? Like, alright, you're going to pay me $120 million to play basketball? Am I worth $120 million? Maybe not, but apparently on the market I am. Joe Johnson is a top five player in franchise history. He's the best shooting guard in franchise history. He's a guy that whenever he decides to retire after the appropriate length of time, whatever that is, that number two should be hanging in the rafters at Phillips Arena. He is probably the biggest reason that the team was able to make the transition from horrible, awful, terrible 13-69 to, along with some other pieces that came in, to becoming a perennial playoff team and the longest playoff streak in the Eastern Conference. He carried those early teams. That 2008 playoff series was Joe. 2009, Joe. 2010, Joe. That's when, and then you started to see Josh and Al kind of coming around. But I mean, he was phenomenal in Atlanta. And he gets a bad rep. He's not a superstar guy in personality, so I think he just kind of gets a rap as not being a superstar. But the dude was one of the two or three best shooting guards in the league for a long time, you know? So he gets a bad rep. He's going to get booed. It's unfortunate. I hope they don't boo him too much. But every time he touches the ball, they're going to boo him.
All right, to wrap this up, you haven't really gotten to see a team play at this level for a whole season. What was it? What was fun about it for you getting to watch the success they had?
Oh, man, they just played such a fun brand of basketball. I think that's the difference for me is, you know, I've been in the arena for a ton of Hawks teams, and none of them played as good, consistently as good a brand of basketball as this. We saw some flashes of it last year, but they weren't putting it together on a nightly basis. Some of that was injury. But, I mean, this is a team that just 1 through 10, they come in and they all play. They play the system but once. They run the offense. They play hard on defense. They all can shoot. It's a really fun atmosphere to be in. They're all good guys. And it's just one of those things where it was a very strange it was very strange as a Hawks fan because, or even covering the Hawks, because the team gets along really well, and you feel that in the locker room. That's brand new. We hadn't seen that before. A bunch of guys actually wanted to hang out with each other. Joe and Josh just kind of did their own thing, which is fine, but it's interesting to see that. And it carried over on the court, and you saw it, and they were all, you know, it's sharing the ball, it's doing all, it's incredibly fun, and to be honest, what would be a disappointment for me would be if they stopped playing that kind of basketball. If they play their style and they go out in the second round, then they go out in the second round, that's fine. To be honest, that, you know, it's if they tried to do something different, which they're not going to do. This season's been a success no matter what happens in the playoffs. I'd love to see them get to the Eastern Conference Finals. I'd love to see them possibly beat the Cavs, but to be honest, whatever happens, this has been the best Hawks season I've ever been a part of as a fan or covering a team.
No, that's a good attitude you have about it. And I've always been a person who's rooted for LeBron in the playoffs, but in the East this year, I'm rooting for the Hawks. I want to see you guys. It'd be cool if you guys were able to get out of that conference, even if it seems somewhat unlikely. From Atlanta, we head up the I-95 to talk about the Brooklyn Nets. David Wurzberger from brooklynsfinestblog.com, along with HP, has also done some work in some other places too. David, how you doing today?
Good, Brian. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you. So, the Nets. Did you think they were going to get in as the season was ending?
Honestly, I expected them to blow it. I mean, they were down. I didn't watch the game, but they were down to Orlando for a good part of that. It just seemed very Nets of them. That may sound unfair, but that's just how the season has gone. They have all this talent. They have Brooke Lopez, who's just now starting to play out of his mind. They have former All-Stars, Darren Williams, Joe Johnson. Lionel Hollins has been known to be a good defensive coach and such, but, God, they seem to always find a way to disappoint their fan base.
Is there any, I mean, Hollins, and he does do some good things, but, like, he continues to play Jack and Darren Williams together. He continues to play Brooke Lopez and Plumlee together for stretches. Do you think now that it's playoff time and it's winner go home and there's no other place to go that he kind of cleans up his lineups, or is he going to keep playing the stuff the data says isn't very good?
You know, to his credit, he's cut down on the Lopez Plumlee lineup in the second part in post All Star break. The same with the Williams Jack lineup. He's still gone to it at times. There was one post-game injury where he said he'd stop going to Williams and Jack, but he did anyway. So, I'd like to hope so, because the data really says those are horrible lineups. The eye test proves the same thing. Plumlee and Lopez just kill spacing. Jack can't really defend anyone nowadays. So I like to see them go away. I feel like it'd be hopeful to think they would go away. I'm not sure how Hollins will approach this series, but if those lineups are a factor, the Hawks they already have such an advantage. Like, this would just make it a definite four-game sweep.
What is Keith Lopez's resurgence? Because he's been, I think, what is he, won three straight Player of the Week awards or something like that, I think?
I believe so. What, the three or two?
Yeah, but, something like that. That doesn't matter. Just a stupid thing to bring up.
Yeah, the Keith, I mean, getting to play with a guy like that young, who stretches the floor, changing the types of shots he's been looking for. A lot of his early season stuff was just isolating post-ups down low, not passing when the help came, and just trying to hit a hook shot over two guys. Even then, he was playing sort of passably, but now he's just been destroying on the pick and roll with Darren Williams, who's a lot more of a threat than Jared Jack there. So since Williams has come back, defenders have had to choose between letting Williams get a good look or Lopez get a good look, and Lopez has just knocked down that little in-between floater. He's finished well. He's getting his own offensive rebounds a lot. So he's taken on a bigger role with this Nets team, with Kevin Garnett gone and Thad Young not much of an inside big man. He's a stretch four, essentially. So Lopez has just been killing it down low. It's mostly been sort of these different things, Williams coming back and Young being inserted into the lineup, opening up these new opportunities for him.
How has Young fit in since the trade? It sounds like it's been pretty positive.
You know, considering the Nets' reputation for transactions, or rather I say general manager Billy King's reputation, the Young KG deal was like one of the best trades of the season, because the Nets' offense, I don't have the exact numbers on me, but their offensive rating, every measurement possible, they have just jumped offensively since that Young trade, and since he's been inserted into the starting lineup, he stretches the floor, he can create. His defense and rebounding aren't fantastic, but offensively, the Nets were just so hard to watch throughout the season, and ever since he's come here, they've been a lot easier to watch. You know, he's been knocking down threes, another pick and roll, pick and pop option with Darren Williams, so that was just a great trade for the Nets.
And Williams looks a little bit fresher lately, right? It seems like he's playing better. This is the best stretch of hoops he's had this season.
Yeah, it hasn't been a huge stretch. He's been really on and off. One game he'll look fantastic, the next not so much. He sat out a few games. I don't know if that's helped him sort of, you know, get some energy back. Him playing well is going to be key to the Nets in the series, because it's him or Jack or Darius Morris, I guess, if you want to count him. But
that's a good honest. Michigan man right there.
Sorry, I didn't mean to insult, but he's been... Anyway, I'm going to go back to Williams now before you kick me off this call.
No, you're allowed to insult Darius Morris. It's okay.
I don't mean to insult him. He's just not a very good point guard or basketball player. He still manages to get on these rosters, so I don't really feel bad about making fun of him, because he's still making all this money. But, you know, Williams, he's really on and off. One night he'll look 40, the next he'll look back to being 25. There's no really pattern to the madness. It's just sort of how he's feeling. So honestly, it's another case of just hoping. There's really no way of telling how he does in the series.
Who do you think they have chasing around Korver?
I'm actually writing a little preview in which I list three keys and three certainties. One of the certainties is that the Nets don't have anyone to chase Korver. He's going to absolutely destroy the Nets. I mean, Marco Brown right now is the starting two. I love him. He's young, he's feisty, he's scrappy, but chasing around Korver, he's not terrific going around screens. He is quick, and he can leap. He's blocked a few jumpers. I'd like to see him try and chase Korver, but if he's the Nets' best option, which it looks like he is, I mean, Allen Anderson and Bojan Bogdanović, they aren't fast. Neither is Joe Johnson. You know, the Nets' point guards don't. That might be a scenario where Hollins might look and say, oh, we should do Williams and Jack, but that's probably not going to do it either, because neither of those guys are super quick, and they won't have the length or height to really get up in Korver's face, which hasn't even done anything this season because Korver's shooting the lights out. So it's going to be brown. It's not going to be pretty.
It sounds like a job maybe 3 years down the road Brown might be a little bit more equipped for, but not in his rookie year.
That yeah, absolutely.
He has the physical tools, but the mind just isn't there yet for a seven-game playoff series against a team run by a Spurs veteran coach.
Well, now, let's not kid ourselves. This isn't going to seven.
Yeah. Okay, good good point. I have one friend who is a Nets fan. I grew up in New York my whole life. I know one person. And he is so excited that they made the playoffs. I was like, dude, really?
The Nets aren't keeping their pick anyway, so might as well.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, it doesn't. There was no reason for them not to go for it, but there's also no really reason to get all pumped up and fired up for this series.
It's gonna hurt. It's not gonna be pretty if you're a Nets fan.
Oh, 4.5 over under.
I'm gonna go over. I think the Nets will squeak out one, because they can have one of those games where they just get hot. I went to a Nets Warriors game this year, and the Nets ended up winning that one, and it was just because nobody would miss. I mean, Jared Jackson's going to have a 25-point game in the series. I'm certain of that, despite the season he's had. He seems to always have that one game. He's just going to make every mid-range jumper. The Nets will win one, I think.
All right, you snuck one plug in. You got anything else you want to get out there?
No, I mean, you know, feel free to log onto the blogs. You know, read about the Nets if you must. If you want to read about the Nets, I might you know, suggest that you reevaluate some things. But, you know, if you do want to read about the Nets, you should come check it out.
Well, that was a superb way of telling people not to go to your website. Well done. Go to brooklynsfinestblog.com to check out everything, your latest news for the Nets. That's a part of the ESPN True Hoop Network. David, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And we reach our final series to preview in the Eastern Conference with the Washington, with the fourth-seeded Toronto Raptors going up against the fifth-seeded Washington Wizards. The Raptors swept Washington in the regular season, only three games. Game one is at Toronto, 12:30. You can see that on ESPN. To help us talk about the Wizards, BulletsForever.com's Jake Whitaker. Jake, how you doing today?
How are you, Brian?
I'm good. I'm starting to. I really can't talk anymore with all these I've taped today. But I'm battling through. That's I struggled through that intro, but we made it. We got to you finally. So
struggling, right?
So 3-0 against 0-3 against the Raptors. Two of the games were really close. To me, it feels like this should be a series that goes pretty long, and that regular season won't really be an indication. Agree or disagree?
Yeah, I think it's just one of those things. Both teams just can't get out of their own way enough to, you know, finish the series decisively. So, yeah, I'm definitely expecting 6, if not 7, for this one, whichever way.
Last year, the Wizards advanced in the first round because they physically dominated Chicago inside. Could you see a similar scenario playing out this year against Toronto's front line?
I'm not sure, because I think the thing that's been really killing Washington lately is just they don't really have a stretch four. So when the Raptors bring out Patterson, you know, they just don't know how to match up with them on that aspect. And, you know, where the Bulls, you know, they were kind of just beaten up. I just think the Raptors, they don't, you know, if the Wizards start pounding them inside, then they're just going to force the Wizards to go small to keep up.
Is that bad? Do you not think the Wizards can hang if they go to Pierce at the four?
Well, I think if they do go to Pierce at the four, they have a great shot. But the problem is they haven't used him there much at all this season. So the question is, will Whitman finally give in to that, you know, kind of looking at how he worked so effectively there last year for Brooklyn, and then does he trust Otto Porter to then fill in at small forward, or does he go with, you know, Rizzle Butler or something? I mean, I think that's their best shot. I just, you know, Whitman really hasn't given any indication that he'll start using him in power forward, so.
It would seem that Patterson's about the perfect matchup for a guy like Pierce to go small against. He's not going to kill him inside. He's just going to have to close out on his pick and pop threes and those threes he gets off of ball movement. And then Pierce will be able to, he'll have someone who, he's not the fleetest of foot anymore, but he should have more foot speed than Patterson and be able to beat him off the dribble.
Right. Yeah, and that's what it seems like the perfect matchup to use Pierce at the four. And, you know, if the Wizards go down without using him there, it's just going to, you know, if they think Nene is the solution to just kind of, you know, batter Patterson into not being useful, I just don't think that's going to go well.
So are the Wizards going to be able to overcome Randy Whitman in this series seems to be the question.
Right. That's the thing. I could almost see, I do think in a weird way the playoffs almost are somewhat better suited for Randy Whitman and this roster, because you can, you know, they don't have the greatest depth, but in the playoffs you can kind of get past that. You don't need to run Kevin Seraphin out there for 12 minutes. You don't need to, you know, rely on a lot of the bench guys that aren't super productive. But, you know, the question is, will Whitman kind of break some of those tendencies? And, you know, last year, to his credit, he did a bit, but it seems like this year, more than ever, he's just kind of decided to stick his feet in the mud and say, this is how we're going to do it. And so, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if it's just, him kind of, you know, kind of hiding the game tape and kind of, you know, saving Paul Pierce, you know, at power forward till they really need him to kind of, you know, save the wear and tear, or if it's just this is how it's going
to
be.
Doesn't really sound like you believe that he's smart enough to be hiding game tape.
I don't, but then again, you know, last year he did just enough of it to kind of almost work. And so, you know, I do think there is kind of a little bit of a poker face, especially when it comes to, you know, what Whitman says in some of his post-game pressers. He just kind of, you know, shouts effort, you know, every third word and to stop asking questions. So, you know, I do think there is kind of something there, but it's just a matter of, you know, how much he's willing to just completely throw out everything that, you know, they did in the regular season to take advantage of this matchup.
Advantage, John Wall or Kyle Lowry?
I'm going to say... All right, this is my cop-out answer. It's a push, which is advantage Raptors. I think they essentially balance each other out, and if, you know, you essentially neutralize John Wall, then I think the rest of the Raptors beat the rest of the Wizards.
Beal's been good, not great this year. Is this a series you can see him breaking out in, or do you think he kind of just goes along the same path he's been all season?
I think the Bulls would have given him a better chance to kind of step up. I think the Raptors, I think between Ross and DeRozan, they've got, you know, that kind of sneaky length that, you know, just baits him into taking that 16-footer, which is, you know, just the worst place to have him. And so I'm not sure he's going to have that same breakout like we saw last year against Chicago and Indiana.
Yeah, and he's not Joe Johnson. The Raptors in that series against the Nets last year got beat up by Joe Johnson, just basically bully-balled them. Beal can't, you don't really see Beal, that's not Beal's style.
No, I mean, he definitely kind of, you know, you look at his frame and you think, you know, geez, he should be able to do more of that, but he's just not comfortable there yet.
Your confidence level for this series, I'd put, it seems like at like a negative 8 or negative 10.
Yeah, I mean, it's the good thing is, you know, a lot of people have been saying, you know, oh, the Bulls would have been a better matchup for the Wizards, but I like the Raptors because they've kind of been at the same kind of point of despair lately, and, you know, I do like that part of it. I don't trust, you know, the Wizards to have that same kind of run like they did last year, but I do think there's something to be said for, you know, again, I think as weird as it is, the Wizards are a little bit better suited for playoff basketball, and that is where they might be able to kind of hide some of their glaring weaknesses. And, you know, they still might have another surprise left in them.
Are you typically a negative fan, or do you usually take a positive perspective?
I don't think you can be a Wizards fan without being incredibly negative after all. But, I mean, you always want to hope for the best, and I do think there is, you know, plenty of reason to believe the Wizards have a good shot here. I just, you know, I'm not going to invest myself fully in thinking, oh, the Wizards have this, but I do almost feel more comfortable in this series than I do last year, for what it's worth.
Do you have anything you would like to plug or get out there?
Yes. Follow our Twitter, at Bullets Forever. John Wall followed us today for some reason, so apparently we must be on the right track there.
Because
so,
he thinks you, because he sees you're getting Kevin Durant.
I hope so. part of the plan.
Well, that's what KD's past and future home. I'm reading directly from your Twitter account.
You have to see it to believe it. You have to believe it to visualize, and that's how it's going to happen.
All right. Do you have anything specific that's going up there that people should know about and all that good stuff? You guys doing anything playoff-wise?
Yeah, we got a few different playoff preview posts up. We actually just did one about Wall versus Lowry, who's got the, you know, just kind of breaking down where each player has different advantages. And we've also got a post up about, you know, just how Paul Pierce playing at power forward could be the thing that really, you know, gives the Wizards the advantage should they choose to use it. So, yeah, definitely check those out.
We hit on all relevant topics here. See, so go to bulletsforever.com to get a more in-depth look at we kind of scratched the surface with. Jake, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. We'll talk. Thank you, Jake. We'll talk to you later. Appreciate it, Matt.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Now heading to the north for the Raptors part of the Wizards-Raptors series, I am joined by Sarar Siddiqui from RaptorsRepublic.com. Sarar, how you doing today?
Good, man. Excited about the playoffs.
Yeah, are you Raptors fans, are they – last year the crowd was incredible there. Is there the same sort of excitement around the city?
I think you'll find the crowd even more primed this year because the expectations are a little higher. I think last year we were kind of happy to be there. This time there's real expectations and there's real excitement. And I think once the ESPN cameras roll, they'll pick up the Jurassic Park, as they call it, outside the ACC. There's going to be thousands of fans out there. Should be a party.
Do you think that's a little dangerous, or do you think the team's ready for that?
I think that motivates the team. I think they've gone on record saying how much they enjoyed that aspect of Toronto and how passionate the fans are and how they support the team. So I think it helped the team last year, and I don't see why it would, wouldn't help them even more this year.
All right, so last year their downfall in that first series against the Nets was they couldn't contain Joe Johnson. A bigger wing was able to body up DeRozan, body up Ross, kind of hurt their two-point guard line. Well, the two-point guard lineups were actually really good. But they went out, they acquired James Johnson. That's kind of been something he's done this year. Is that enough, or are they still going to struggle with that in the postseason?
Well, against the Nets, I think they had a caliber of small forward or a wing player in Joe Johnson that the Raptors didn't really have an answer for. I think if that series was played again and you had had James Johnson at your disposal, I think the Raptors would fare a lot better. Having said that, I don't know if the Wizards possess that kind of a wing player like Joe Johnson. So I don't think the Raptors have to worry about exactly that sort of matchup this year. I think that was more specific to last year's Brooklyn series. This year, I think things might get easier on that front, but harder on other fronts.
That's actually a really good point, that Pierce and Rasul Butler, Martell Webster, they're not bringing the same kind of back-to-the-basket game that Joe Johnson have, so it's not as relevant. What issues are you most worried about then from the Wizards' perspective?
Well, I think arguably, or not arguably, I think John Wall is probably the best player in the series. So right now you really have to worry about the point guard situation, especially with Kyle Lowry, you know, who missed a bunch of games towards the end of the season. And since he came back, he's played really heavy minutes, which is kind of odd. In the three games he's played. John Wall, you have to worry about because the Raptors this season have been quite poor at defending dribble penetration. So John Wall is number one concern right now. And more importantly, you know, in this league, one-on-one, anybody can beat anybody. It's the question is, how do you support once the guy is beaten? And the Raptors, in their help defense, haven't always been great. Jonas Valanciunas, who mans the paint, tends to get in a lot of foul trouble when guards come in. Amir Johnson hasn't been healthy. He missed a bunch of games towards the end of the season. So it's that initial point of attack that Wall can give you, combined with the Raptors' somewhat suspect help defense for guards who are driving in, which causes the most concern. But at the same time, John Wall has this tendency to shoot a lot of jumpers. So if you're a Dwayne Casey right now, you're hoping Wall kind of adapts that jumper approach.
Why has Toronto's defense dipped compared to what it was last year?
That's a really good question. I think if you look at the major changes to the roster, you know, only James Johnson is a big addition, obviously, but he's a defensive guy, so you would think that would make things better. And Lou Williams off the bench, he's playing a lot of minutes. And I think it goes beyond just individuals. I think it's more team philosophy. I think this year's Raptors are much more reliant on individuals to create their own offense. They're much more offensive focused than last year's team. I think last year's team was almost like a socialist offense with ball movement being a premium. this year it's very ISO heavy, and the players they've gotten in, especially Lou Williams, is very ISO heavy. So the focus has been primarily on getting the offense to work, and defense has been a bit of an afterthought. But that's just at a high level. I think the core problem with the Raptors' defense is that Dwayne Casey tends to play a very, very aggressive defense, which is really heavy on trapping. They hedge hard. They like to rotate a lot. They don't. They put a lot of pressure on their guys to actually make a lot of rotations. And I don't know if the Raptors have the personnel to execute on that plan, and that's why they've struggled. So guys like Patrick Patterson, you'll see him checking a five. You'll see Tyler Hansbrough doing a closeout at the perimeter. You'll see James Johnson scrambling all over the place, trying to prevent three-point shots. So it's the type of defense Dwayne Casey has put out there, combined with the players who may not necessarily have the talent level to play that defense, or at least if you look at the Raptors roster, there's no like shutdown defender or even like marginally good defenders on that roster, but the defense that they've been asked to play calls for that kind of player, and it's kind of a cognitive mismatch there.
Now, the Raptors they can go with a couple different styles in their front court. Do you expect them to try and match up and bruise with the Wizards, or to take the opposite approach and try and space them out and take Nene and Gortat out of their comfort zone?
Yeah, I think it has to be the latter, just based on the evidence of this season. Dwayne Casey really does like to play a smaller lineup, where you see Patrick Patterson perhaps at the five, and the Wizards have had problems guarding the stretch four this year. So I could see a smaller lineup really being used a lot. That's kind of made Raptor fans a little mad, because that means Jonas Valanciunas, who fans love, tends to ride the pine. But I think you'll see a lot of small ball played by the Raptors and really force Nene to come out. I actually made a post today on Raptors Republic, which talked about, which broke down basically Washington's weakness, which is they really put Nene in help situations, and he's not really great at helping and then rotating out. So the clips that I posted kind of prove that, like what the areas in Washington's defense is that can be exploited by the Raptors. So yeah, to answer your question, I fully expect to see some smaller lineups out there.
Do the Raptors, you talked about how the expectations are high for this team. Do the Raptors need to win a round for this nucleus to stay together?
Well, if you look at the nucleus, I think that nucleus is still to be defined. I think you see DeMar DeRozan's part of that. Obviously, Kyle Lowry, who signed a long-term deal, is. Patrick Patterson, you might call it that. And Jonas Valanciunas, obviously. But beyond that, if you look at guys like Ross, they're really on the periphery of the team at this point. So I think regardless of what happens this year, the core guys, DeRozan, Lowry, and Valanciunas, stay put for sure. I don't think a first-round exit would mean that you got to ship those guys. But you might see some major changes across the roster, but not those three guys. So the nucleus kind of stays put regardless of what happens. But if they get out of the first round, or if they lose in the first round, I should say, I think it'll be a major disappointment, and a lot of questions will be asked of the roster.
Who do you think would catch the Heat? I did this with the Rockets section of this. I asked the same question, but I like it for here too. Who do you think catches the Heat if they do get bounced by Washington?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. I mean, the easy answer is the coach, Dwayne Casey, but it depends really what the manner of the loss is, right? I mean, if they get out-coached again, like they did last year by Jason Kidd, who, when Dwayne Casey refused to put Landry Fields on Joe Johnson, even though he was a decent defender and had done something in Game 2 to prove that, like if we lose like that again, I think a lot of questions will be asked of Dwayne Casey. If the Raptors lose in a way where their offense is very isolation heavy and we're getting a lot of bad shots in crunch time, that kind of speaks to the coach and his planning. So it depends on the manner of the loss, but the coach kind of has to take the blame. The guy who won't take the blame, I can tell you that much, is the GM, Masai Ujiri, who's riding high on popularity in the city. So he's pretty much safe because he's really turned this team around. So I'd say the coach more than anything.
I could have sworn, I read an article, I think it was from Sam, I want to say, that was kind of negative about Ujiri, right? That was him?
I don't know. I don't think Sam writes that much. He just had a second baby, so he's in hiatus big time.
I could have sworn it was on your website, and it wasn't killing him. It's just that it was about Ujiri being a little bit too conservative.
That was written by Tim W., who is our resident critic, even in good times. So Tim's had a different you know, a couple of different viewpoints. He was definitely on Tank Nation last year, where he urged the Raptors to tank for Wiggins. But that didn't work out. So I think now he's adopted an approach that Ujiri should have done something at the deadline to actually do something in the playoffs. But, you know, like the one thing Ujiri has been crystal clear about throughout his tenure here is that he's not going to make short-term moves just to get short-term gains. He definitely has a long-term in mind. So I don't expect any kind of moves which give up assets just to win a playoff round. I think he would prefer losing a playoff round and getting some maturity in the players and go that way rather than just immediate gratification.
Okay, so that the premise of that article doesn't permeate through the rest of Raptors fan. They're generally pretty happy.
No. I think we're quite excited. I think we're quite excited about things, and there's a sense of optimism around the team. But then again, the expectation that you win the first round, and now that you got the winner of Atlanta and Indiana, I think it is, in the second round, there's even some expectation that you should fare well in the second round as well. So expectations are high. Raptor fans are glad that they did not sacrifice assets. I think we really would have liked to see some interior defense being picked up at the deadline. But then you look at the price Cleveland played for Mozgov. Those kind of players are really expensive, and there aren't really that many out there. At the same time, the Raptors have a couple of projects sitting on the bench. Lucas Nogueira, Bebe, he's one of them. He's a couple of years away at least, and you have Bruno Caboclo. So maybe those guys can develop into some good defensive players and maybe provide that protection, especially Bebe. But yeah, I mean, I can't blame Ujiri for not making a move, because it's really hard to make moves at the deadline for the exact need you have, because teams know what you're looking for and the price will naturally be inflated.
Well, I am a Knicks fan, so I just want to let you know it's mandatory that I've been holding up a middle finger to you the entire time for the trade.
Why did the Knicks win those last couple of games and reduce their odds? Like, what is going on there?
No, I can't explain anything. They do.
They didn't even tank properly.
No, they don't do many things properly. Hopefully they do something better this summer. But no, this is a playoff preview.
This is a playoff preview, but let me just put you on the spot. Like, is Derek Fisher a decent coach or what?
I don't think it's fair to judge him after this season, because he's had so little at his disposal. He's done some things that have worried me. He does some things that I like.
So he's had a rookie head coach season, basically.
Yes, exactly, with a team that doesn't have NBA players on it, which makes it even harder to pick up.
Yeah, you're right, man. Knicks talk is boring. Let's move on.
Exactly. All right, would you have anything else you would like to plug over at RaptorsRepublic.com before we wrap up?
No, the site is RaptorsRepublic.com. We're covering the Raptors throughout the NBA playoffs. It's a good site. Check it out if you're a Raptor fan, if you don't already do so. And I have a podcast that airs every Monday morning, the Raptors Weekly Podcast. Check it out. Download it. It's on iTunes and blah, blah, blah. So hope to see you guys there.
Yep. All right. Good stuff. And if you guys advance in the playoffs, look forward to catching up with you down the road.
Oh, we will be catching up. No.
I like the comments. All right. Thanks a lot, Zara. I appreciate it.
Glad to be on.
All right, that wraps up the Eastern Conference first round playoff preview over at the Podium Game.